This is Focus with Emma Griffiths on ABC Radio Brisbane.
What's gone wrong with federal politics? Is it us? Is it the voters? Is it the media? Is it the leaders? The parties? Is it the system? Is it vested interests? Lobbyists? Politics these days, it feels so fractured and fractious. One day, leaders are safe, policies are locked in, but a negative poll, or 27 later, and that leader's gotta go. That policy was obviously wrong. What do you reckon? What's gone wrong in federal politics? 1300 222 612. To text, it's 0467 922 612. On Facebook, the page is ABC Brisbane. The question's up there for you, and there's already been a fantastic conversation happening there amongst some of you. So if that's where you would prefer to leave your thoughts, head to Facebook as well.
Focus with Emma Griffiths on ABC Radio Brisbane.
And saying hello this morning as well to Anne Tiernan, who is from Griffith University and here for the duration of the show. Hello, Anne.
Morning, Emma.
First, though, it is 7 years ago to the day Prime Minister Kevin Rudd was ousted by Julia Gillard. 5 years ago, tomorrow, it was Kevin Rudd ousting Julia Gillard. 2.5 years ago, it was the current Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, ousting Tony Abbott. And ever since, it's felt like Tony Abbott is trying to oust Malcolm Turnbull. On the other side, at the moment, there are distinct murmurings if Bill Shorten missteps, Anthony Albanese will be ready and willing. But today, it's the Nationals switching leader after Barnaby Joyce's personal life became the focus. Once upon a time, it was a little less fractious, wasn't it? Or is that just a fictional fairy tale my own rose-tinted glasses have cooked up? John Anderson was a federal parliamentarian for 16 years, from 1989. He was a National Party leader and, as such, a man who held the post of Deputy Prime Minister for 6 years. Might be able to clear it up for me a bit. John Anderson, hello.
Hello, good to be with you.
Now, there were leadership tensions in the past, weren't there? I mean, Peacock and Howard, Hawke and Keating. But it was different, right?
Yeah, there are actually patterns. Over the years that Australia has been a federated nation, a lot of instability in the early years, right through really until probably the Second World War in many ways, but then 50s, 60s, 70s, I'd say right through until about 2007. Surprising overall stability in Australia. It's very concerning to see where it's going now, because I suspect one of the things we're not being honest about here is that it's, to some extent now, it's actually driven from the grassroots. It's from bottoms up, not tops down.
What do you mean by that?
I actually think that to a very great degree, what is now happening is that the electorate is fragmenting, that we're a fractured people. We focus more on what we disagree on than what we agree on as Australians. Age of social media, the sort of bile of the Twitterati, spilling out into a demand for instant solutions, a lack of patience, and an insistence that what I want matters more than what my neighbour wants or what the country wants. That's a tough assertion, but I actually think there's an element of that that we need to be conscious of as a country as well.
What is that leading to then in politics?
Well, we're not careful. We as a society, we lose our way. I think it's very serious. I really do. And we start to eat ourselves out, as so many other cultures have in the past. We go from being a stable people focused on the long-term interests of the nation and our children and our grandchildren to wanting instant gratification and demanding that if our politicians don't provide it, we'll chuck them out.
Are parties responding to this then in too much of a knee-jerk fashion?
I think there's an element of truth in that. Yes, I do. It is my personal view, I may be wrong on this, but it's my personal view that Labor would have won a second election under Rudd and that the Liberal Party would have won a second election under Abbott.
Controversial.
Yeah, it may be. But I think that would be my answer to your question, are they panicking too much? The other thing about it is ANU does some very interesting work. You know, we're tracking election results and people's attitudes and so forth. And one of the things that you see is that if you go back, see, I'm not so terribly young now, I'm 60-ish. You go back to when I was a kid and you'd come out of a long year of enormous stability under Menzies, there was a surprisingly high degree of trust in relation to the perception that politicians were acting in our interest, not their own. It was badly broken from the 70s on for quite a while. It was restored a little for a while under Hawke. It was restored surprisingly strongly in 1996 when Keating lost and Howard and the government that I was part of came into power. That was dissipated away again. But the striking thing about that work, as I understand it, and I don't pretend to be an analyst, but in 2007, there was a massive resurgence of confidence. People thought, here is a man leading a government that we can believe in again, and we think they're about us, not themselves, and we trust them. What happened then was it collapsed incredibly quickly, and the trust, on, as I read the ANU analysis, has broken down very, very badly indeed, reached perhaps its worst ever levels in terms of their research, and there's been no sort of restoration of any confidence when people get a new government.
And so what's to blame in that sense then, John Anderson?
Well, here again, a slightly unusual answer out of left field. I have a bit of a suspicion that in many ways the stability under Hawke and Keating, even though that, you know, Keating in the end went because people didn't like his style very much. I think that had a lot to do with it. And then under Howard, created a false perception in a couple of areas that were very significant. One was that, governing can't be all that hard. It looks easy, when in fact it's unbelievably hard. Trust me, I've been there. You know, people sometimes flippantly say to me, oh, you were Deputy Prime Minister, wouldn't you like to have been Prime Minister? Well, I did 43 stints in that position, and I tell you, it ain't easy.
It makes me wonder now, John Anderson, if Malcolm Turnbull is sometimes going, oh, I don't really want this job anymore.
Well, you know, in some ways he's in good company. You know, there have been a couple of US presidents that have confided in their diaries that they do anything to get out of it and to be able to live a human life again, and a couple of them were very, very successful and very powerful men indeed, and you'd think they'd be lapping it up and enjoying it, whereas in reality their sense of responsibility, if they're taking it seriously, is overwhelming. And I think the other thing that's happened, though, is that it's closely related. During that period of reform, in many ways the country went ahead. Employment was fixed, real wages started to rise. The feeling emerged that it will get better every year and we don't have to make tough decisions. And now whenever anybody tries to make a tough decision, aided by social media, you know, the Twitterati goes mad. The bile, the way we talk to one another as Australians. As an Australian, I can't believe it. We need to wake up. We need to start saying, where do people get it, the idea that it's appropriate to call into question the very character, almost the right to exist, of their fellow Australians if they disagree with them? Most Australians hate that stuff. But the evidence is pretty overwhelming that there are more and more of them engaging in it all the time.
Mm. John Anderson, we put the question out on Facebook, speaking of social media, last night to listeners, what's gone wrong with federal politics? And Lynette came back to us saying that Politicians only care about the next election, not beyond that. It has been this way for decades. They need to get on with governing the country rather than caring if the decision is popular and will lose them votes. That seems to go to that point that you're making. Are politicians not standing by their convictions?
Yeah, there's a very, very strong sense of that in the research. Now, again, I want to stress to you and your listeners, I'm not an analyst, but I, you know, watched this stuff for a long time, and I'm not so young anymore. So maybe my views ought to, you know, got some credit. I hope they have. Hope they at least get a discussion going. But yeah, my understanding of the research is, it shows just that people really do think now that they're just in it for themselves. Now, unfortunately, I'm not going to claim innocence on the part of the political players. We've had too many instances where people have behaved in ways that have confirmed that very suspicion. And one of the things that distresses me about that is that there are, you know, a lot of good people, even people that I might disagree with ideologically on other sides, but they're very well-meaning. They really do care. They are trying to make a difference. But you end up with people being so cynical, they say, they tar everyone with the same brush and say, oh, you know, they're all just as bad. And that, you know, it's a sort of almost self-fulfilling prophecy. If we're going to say, oh, they're only in it to line their own nests, well, good people who want to make a contribution will say, well, I won't be able to get over the cynicism, so there's no point coming forward, you know.
May as well line my own nest.
Or stay out of it. This is a great problem. I often comment, you know, that when John Howard stood for Bennelong, we're talking about three Conservative seats here, but blue ribbon seats. There were 33, I think, in the pre-selection, and many of them were very eminent. When I stood for Gwydir, which was a blue ribbon seat in 1988, there were 12 candidates initially, two pulled out, who wanted the blue ribbon job. You know, if you won the pre-selection, that is to say, you ended up as a federal member. But when I resigned, I was staggered at how few people wanted to run for a blue ribbon seat. They didn't want to do it.
It's because you told them how hard the job was, John Anderson.
No, I didn't tell them that.
No, but why do you think that happened?
Well, one of them came to me and he said, John, I'd personally like to do it, but my wife and my kids are just aghast at the idea. They think it's too intrusive. Another one came to me and he said, you know, Andrew, I'm one of your, you know, I knew him reasonably well and had a very high regard, and I'd said to him, listen, mate, you really ought to think about this, have a go at it. And he said to me, you know, I really want to do it. And he came to me, he said, give me a month. And he came to me then and he said, you know, I'm one of the blokes who's always said, you fellas are overpaid. And I sat down and I thought about it and I thought there's no way I'd wear all that intrusiveness for twice the money. Now, we were fortunate because, and I say this really seriously, the fellow who did step up and the party chose in my place is as honest as the day is long. I've never seen a harder working man, and no one is cynical about our member out here. I haven't met anybody who's cynical about Mark Colton and his own electorate. And I just say that because I'd hate people to say that I thought anything other than that of him.
Okay, John Anderson,
they are there.
Interesting of you to mention there that one of the prospective candidates was concerned, like his wife and children were like, no way on the intrusion, because we've just seen that unfold over the last 3 weeks. And I'm wondering what you think then about the media's role in all of this. Is it too intrusive? Is it carrying too much power? I mean, particularly over Barnaby Joyce, it feels like some of the News Limited papers have just run day after day, headline after headline. They were calling for him to go long before any of his own MPs were.
I think this episode has showed that our society no longer knows how to deal with these issues, and neither does the media. And I actually think that's a really serious issue for us. I should say that I am one of those people who, and I know this has been one of the issues, I do subscribe to the view that a man or a woman should, you know, you can tell a great deal about whether they'll be trustworthy in public by whether they are trustworthy in private. I have to say that. So I think that makes it even more complex. Where does the line lie? But one of the issues here is that we've lost the language to talk around some of the things that would have been open and shut in terms of behaviour. And I do note that, you know, people approve of the so-called, can I say it on the ABC, the bonking ban?
I'd love you to. Thank you. Can you say it again?
the ban on sex between ministers and their staff. But it reduces sexual morality to an issue of power, not what's right and wrong in many ways. And I wonder, and I think to myself, I wonder how families actually really feel about that. And people have mixed feelings. Now, I want to be careful here because I don't think people like politicians or ex-politicians moralising. But I do want to say that there was a time when there was a great deal more glue that held us together on what we would accept and what we wouldn't. And I think one of the dangers here is we have lost sight of this idea because I'm afraid I think it's important. I always applied it, always, from a very early age. I thought to myself, if I can see somebody whose behaviour is trustworthy in private, then there's a fair chance I can regard them as trustworthy in public. That's a tough thing to say, but I'm afraid it is perfect. The point I want to make, it is perfectly obvious to me, and I think the media should take some note of this, that the very high levels of approval for a measure that should not be necessary, call it the bonking ban, it has very strong acceptance. What does that tell you? People do get the connection.
And politicians often campaign around the fact that they have a stable home life. They send out Christmas cards as MPs of themselves with their family. It becomes part of their public role, doesn't it?
Well, I think, again, that tells you that even today, people in the community, I mean, politicians are not stupid. They know what matters to people. They're tapping into something that Australians think is important. So, again, I would say, you know, look, let's be really brutal about this. An awful lot of the public commentary comes from people in the media and so forth who are in a different headspace on things like family values to where mainstream Australians are at. So you get a cynicism from the commentary which doesn't quite square up with what I would call the horse sense and the headspace of people in the community. I'm sorry to say that on media, but I think these things do need exploring at the moment. Let me try and put this because, you know, it's important to have a philosophical framework here. We live in one of the freest societies ever. In fact, you could say that the West, over the last couple of hundred years, have reached the high point, really, personal and indeed, if you like, societal freedom, and we value that freedom. But that freedom must always be exercised, as our forefathers kept emphasising, within a framework of personal responsibility and societal responsibility. If freedom starts to be confused with licence, so that people think that freedom doesn't mean the thing, you have the right and the opportunity to do the things that matter and are responsible are good for the community, but rather starts to be exercised in terms of I can do whatever I like, then freedom, in fact, becomes its own worst enemy. What do I mean by that? Well, you see it all the time. People exercise license in their personal lives and they end up enslaved.
Mm. John Anderson, so happy to hear your philosophies about what's gone wrong with federal politics. Thank you so much for your time today.
Can I just say we must not lose hope. We are a free country. This is a wonderful country, you know, with many millions of wonderful people. We've just got to learn to debate again properly with respect and with civility, because you never get good public policy and go forward as a nation without a high-quality debate. We can't just be transactional all the time. We've got to go to principle and what's right and what will preserve a good society for our kids and grandkids, because that's what our forebears did for us.
Thank you so much, John Anderson.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
And I wonder if we'll be tuning into Question Time this week for that sort of principled and polite debate. Anne Tiernan is here from Griffith University as well. And some of the comments there, I saw you nodding. Was there something there that stood out to you from what John Anderson had to say?
Well, I was really struck, Emma, by so many of John's comments, and I think it was why many of us regarded him as a very effective Deputy Prime Minister, and were sorry to see him leave public life. I was very interested in him drawing on the Australian election study, which was the data that he was referring to. And he's quite right that the most recent one in 2016 showed that at 26%, trust in politicians in Australia is at its lowest since the question was first asked in 1969. 56% believe that governments run in the interests of just a few, and just 12% think government is for all the people. And what's fascinating about that is that the turning point in that data is 2007, at which there's this precipitous decline in Australia's trust in government. Now, interestingly, so you can kind of get a bit depressed about that. Interestingly, trust in frontline service people, nurses, teachers, doctors, police, AMBOs, never been higher. So it's very interesting about who is attracting the ire of the citizenry, and it seems to me the political class.
The media's still down there with used car salespeople,
isn't it? The Australian election study doesn't look at the media, but the Edelman Trust Barometer does. And yes, indeed, NGOs, the media fell very low, but people can look at those surveys online, and there's good websites for both that summarise that data quite neatly.
Mm. And I was a political reporter, actually, in Canberra for the ABC from 2008 through to coming up here in 2015 and before in the early 2000s as well. And I noted that 2007, things just felt different under Kevin Rudd. And I don't know, and since then, is it also because that's the time when Twitter was really engaged as a way of conducting politics?
Look, I think,
or is it when Twitter became a thing?
Well, look, I think it's really interesting. I've just been in New Zealand, actually, doing some work over there, and the atmosphere around the election of Jacinda Ardern, the country's really excited, and I made myself deeply unpopular in Wellington by saying, God, this reminds me of 2007. Because in a way, the end of a long regime always breeds a bit of excitement. So I think there was, you know, Howard had been in government for a long time. He was seen as having stayed too long by the end, even by his colleagues. There was sort of this outbreak of excitement. So there was something about change. But there was also something about the rise of social media, but it really didn't become that much of a feature until maybe a little bit later. And I think, you know, my work is on the advisory systems that surround prime ministers. And I really see the Gillard period as when that, as when the real uptick in social media happened, but we could debate that off air. So, you know, I think there were a lot of things going on, but the fundamental thing that was implicit to a lot of what John was talking about was globalisation. 2008 brings us the global financial crisis, which really disrupts a lot of what happens in our politics. Lots of people aren't doing very well, actually, stagnant wages, regions performing differently. So there's actually a lot of massive structural changes.
But we did so much better than the rest of the world under the GFC.
But Wayne Swan will tell you, and Kevin Rudd will tell you, that it's like Australians didn't think we had a GFC because we got through that kind of period. But a lot of the frustration with their government came about the implementation of stimulus programs. And I think they feel a bit gypped in terms of their management of the economy. So it's like Australians didn't really understand the global financial crisis, but actually we've seen now the long tail of restructuring and change. So I think a lot of it's about technology. I think it's a lot about civility was a really important theme of what John said. And I think he's so right. Civic discourse has really not been enhanced by social media. But listen, some of the proponents of the worst and most offensive behaviour have in fact been members of the political class. And I think, that whole period of Julia Gillard's tenure was when this really got off the leash. And we can't ignore the misogyny that was inherent to a lot of that in the way that she was dealt with. But, you know, I think John is really right about the loss of civic commitment and respect. But, you know, we need to ask ourselves where that came from. I think it was unleashed by a series of forces.
Anne Tiernan's political scientist, Dean of Engagement in the Business School at Griffith University as well. And today on Focus, asking, what has gone wrong in federal politics? What do you think? I want your views on this. 1300 222 612 to text 0467 922 612 and on Facebook as well. The question is there. Go to page ABC Brisbane, like it, and you can comment there as well. Dave says, what's gone right? We've gone from one disaster to another disaster and back again without achieving anything of any value whatsoever over four terms of divisive, ideological, garbage government. Pedro says political insecurity has increased with the rise of social media and populism. Remember the saying, it doesn't matter if it's popular, what matters is if it's right. Do you know any politicians willing to put that to the test today? John in Carolee says our politicians have egos larger than their abilities. Statesmanlike politicians are rare these days as they all focus on the personality flaws of their peers and not on the governance of our great country. They have no desire to put long-term policies in place because they are afraid their judgments might not return them for another term. They are weak. And Mary is simply thanking us for having John Anderson, former Deputy PM, on air this morning. We do need such down-to-earth views now and again to ground us. We do indeed, Mary. Thank you so much. We need them all the time, really, don't we? Now, I want you to listen to this. If I've got it with me, listen to this bit. I can't tell you with any certainty when Australian politics became purely an ego sport, when it became untethered from shame or modesty or dignity or proportion and just fell face first into its own soap opera, lapsing into a daily practice of coughing up fur balls. Who wrote that? It was the political editor for The Guardian, Catherine Murphy. Hello, Catherine.
Hello. How are you, Emma?
I'm pretty good. Tell us what you really think.
Yes, it was a little bracing, wasn't it? I did feel quite frustrated last week and feel often very frustrated, I must confess, with how politics conducts itself in recent times. But it was sort of the combination of the two Riverview old boys, Tony Abbott and Barnaby Joyce, separately off the long run on their various issues last week, that made me think there is some fundamental losing of the way here, because voters out of Canberra hearing next to nothing about the issues that they're interested in and constantly about people's feelings, ambitions, whether they've behaved appropriately or not. I think that's all pretty alienating for people.
And Catherine, I know you have been in the press gallery and writing about federal politics long enough to have some sort of objective view on whether it is worse now in terms of being fractured and fractious than it has been in previous times. Do you think it is worse now?
I think it is. Yeah, I think it is. And there's a lot of reasons why that's the case. It's not a simple case of it's not just one thing that's happened, but certainly the sort of intensity of the modern news cycle, also the focus on personality and intrigue and palace coups, for want of a better word, has projected us into new territory in Australian politics over the last 10 years, and that's part of the reason why it's worse than it used to be.
And we had John Anderson, former Deputy Prime Minister, on earlier in the show. He was also saying social media plays a role, but also that voters do as well, that people are becoming used to sort of instant gratification, not just in wanting to watch what they want straight away or buy what they want straight away, but having a political leader do something they want straight away. Do you think that's right?
No. I think there's a very complex range of factors that are going on at the present time in society and also in politics and also in the media. I've got a very short book coming out in the middle of the year, Emma, that sort of tries to draw some of these strands together. I think what we're seeing is, obviously, with the sort of technological disruption, the internet, basically playing a very big role in people's lives and the way people receive and share information. That's one factor. There's lots of interesting sort of psychological assessments about whether or not it's shortening people's attention spans and whether or not it's sort of that cycle of instant gratification is becoming more pronounced because of our habits of consuming information. So, and also our habits, I suppose, of searching for information and remembering it. It's quite different in the internet age than it has been previously. So there's a sort of societal factor there. Then in politics and in the media, of course, we've had an intensification of the media cycle where we all know about that. We now all file around the clock and we bring our readers every development as it happens. And that simply didn't happen 10 years ago. We weren't really in that cycle. We had orderly kind of news breaking in radio or in television on the hour. We had print outlets sort of writing once every 24 hours. Now there is this literal fire hose of material coming at people all the time. And that disrupts the cycle of politics because politics is about deliberation and about resolving conflicting points of view. And if that process is constantly interrupted, then you get different outcomes. And then we look at how politics is responding to those things that are changing technologically and in the culture. And what we've seen is this sort of short, sharp, combative, polarised politics, which people feel, you know, we started this conversation with me saying people very alienated from it. There's those sorts of reasons that are alienating voters, that it's combative, that everything is sort of amped up to the max, whether it's a very small thing or whether it's a very large thing. But there is also this cult of personality which is starting to sort of intrude on politics, and that's the thing I was objecting to in that commentary. Because at the end of the day, politics is about public service. And if politics becomes about people's legacies, people's rewards, people's positions, if that's all, you know, that sort of that floats their boat, as it were, if that's all they're prepared, various politicians are prepared to stand up and defend, then we've got a very, very different sort of politics. And it's not a politics I imagine that a lot of Australians are happy with.
No. Catherine, I might just bring in Dave in Samford, who's called in as well. Dave, what do you think has gone wrong with federal politics?
Hi, good morning, Emma, and your listeners. Thank you very much for taking my call this morning. Yes, just been listening to everyone's view on the phone this morning. And I think Dave, who sent in the text message also too, he hit the nail on the head. What I'm about to say is I'm a mature person. I've worked in lots of jobs as a factory worker for 35 going on 40 years. I didn't have a senior education. I left school.
Okay, Dave, I'll just ask you to come to the point on that. We've just got some other callers coming.
I have lots of disabilities because of working in a factory for lots of years. There is thousands of people like me, and I believe over the, you know, the last 50 or, you know, 60 more years, both governments have been exploiting people in the workforce and have a disability. Now, they've managed to get 8,000, 9,000, 10,000 people off the disability pension. And their aim is to get more. Their aim is to get these people back into the workforce. But once again, these people, what is their quality of life? Have they looked into the quality of life? And what is the job to them? It's going to cost them more to actually travel around and inconvenience them. And people with, you know, disabilities, like, they had to go to see a doctor and a specialist in the first place to actually get on a disability. So once again, both governments have exploited this. You know, it goes back to the Labor government where that's where Julie Gillard, she raised the pension. She raised the pension age from 65 to 67. That was a bad idea.
Okay, Dave. Well, Catherine, that sort of goes to your point where we don't hear politicians talking about things that actually matter to people.
Well, that's, yeah, there is that gap that it's almost like that politics sort of tries to settle into a rhythm, talk about a particular policy issue, debate a big idea, and then it gets disrupted by something like the events involving Barnaby Joyce over the past fortnight, or because somebody intrudes on that debate and enters the news cycle and has something to say, which then sort of diverts the conversation and sort of pushes it off in another direction. So I think there is a gap between what the issues that people want to talk about and the issues that politics is routinely talking about. And that's where this frustration stems from.
Another David has commented on our Facebook post about this, saying, "What's wrong with federal politics? The list is too long." Mm-hmm. He goes through the list a bit and then says, "We need a refresh button." Where, if you were to do that, if you were to look at perhaps one element of the system, the voters, the parties, the leaders, where would you start, Catherine?
That's a very complicated exercise. And of course, Emma, we should be fair to a number of people who remain in political life who are thoroughly devoted to the sort of issues that we've been talking about, big debates, big ideas, and continue to prosecute them without sort of diverting off into some sort of, hysterical side issue or whatever else. There are plenty of great people still working in politics, thank heavens, and pushing ahead despite the challenges of the environment. So with that said, how would I refresh it? Well, that's quite complicated because of, it's not like politicians sat around one day and sort of had a seminar about how they could do things most suboptimally and then turned around to the public and delivered this up, right? It's not a question of politicians thinking, how crap can we actually be? And then turning around and delivering that to the public. It's not that simple. There's a range of factors that are happening that influence what we see in Canberra and how politicians conduct themselves. I think part of what would help is if politicians sometimes took a deep breath and remembered that it is actually not all about them, and remembered that they are here in a representative role. And what matters is the views of their constituencies, rather than their own sense of aggrievement or whatever else, right? I think just a deep breath might help. Also, I think there is a lot of deliberate, what I'd call manufactured conflict for its own sake in politics at the moment. There's a degree of tribalism and hyperpolarisation and ad hominem attacks, and that's a choice that people in major party politics can make, whether they want to amp up the conflict all the time or whether they want to move political conversation to something that involves conflict but possibly some consensus as well. And I think that is within the scope of their own power. Politicians, political parties can make that decision. Now, they're not making that decision for a variety of reasons, but again, if we're talking about tangible things, Emma, things we can put our fingers on, things that might make things a little bit better, I would start there.
Catherine Murphy, thank you so much for the chat today.
It's my pleasure, always.
It's the political editor of The Guardian there. So take a deep breath and remember it's not all about you, politicians. Anne Tiernan from Griffith University, where do you think the refresh button could be hit in particular?
Emma, I think we really have to confront the careerism and professionalisation of politics, and that, of course, is one of the significant changes in the last 20 years. I think the lack of diversity, that's diversity of all kinds, backgrounds, experiences, social networks, ideas, is just really problematic in our politics. And, of course, the gatekeepers to pre-selection are ruthless apparatchiks who are are many of them then, you know, achieved, you know, they sign up in student politics and they make their way through. And this is all they know, is hyper-adversarialism, tribalism, all that sort of stuff. I think we really have to, if we want to see what's been a major change, it is that professionalisation. And some of that has brought some really perverse things, I think. The infusions of sort of campaign techniques and ideas from other places, the United States, that really aren't a good fit with our culture. And I think a lot of people's unease is about this you know, tribalism that's come in. And it's, I agree with Catherine entirely, you know, who's a very accurate and evocative analyst of these kinds of issues. We've seen this manufactured behaviour that's more reminiscent of the Tea Party or something that's got no place here than our own sort of ways of doing things. So I'm very concerned about that. We did an edition of Griffith Review in 2016 that was called Fixing the System. And it canvassed a number of, you know, ways of that we might change politics. And it really did, you know, I remember Christine Wallace did a terrific piece on politics as vocation. So that goes to a lot of what Catherine's talked about. But I'm sort of getting to the point, and I wonder if some of your listeners are too, where I'm kind of sick of diagnosing what's wrong with it. I want to know what's going to change and how we're going to change it. And I think what was so extraordinary about the past fortnight was the apparent inability of the people in question to see that there was something wrong, to see that their behaviour was unacceptable, to see that using public funding to create a career pathway was a problem. And I think this is the source of people's kind of, it wouldn't be tolerated in any other domain. So I do think, you know, we have to confront careerism. That would be where I'd start. But how do we stop people being deterred? How do we get that diversity given the stranglehold over pre-selection that the major parties hold?
And I suspect as well, Anne, you feeling like you're sick of diagnosing the problem. Well, I think people are sick of just federal politics. A lot of people, if you look at the last federal poll with the record rate of donkey votes, no good signs there. Steve in Tanimera has called in. Steve, what do you think has gone wrong with federal politics?
But thanks for taking the call, Emma. But look, I agree, it's probably a fairly complex issue. In my profession, I've had some dealings with federal politicians over a period of 20 years on and off. And I know the world's changing, but the old school type operators were more genuine and trusted by the constituents. You could probably say that that's just a corporate change, but of culture in the community. But I've just got I've got to go in a minute, so I've got some quick things, bullet points. There's no trust anymore. No one trusts them. Number two, they're not listening to people. They're not accountable. There's two sets of rules, one for them and one for us. All we hear is excuses. And they're not, more importantly, they're not attracting the right calibre of person. There's a lot of people in the business community which would run rings around these guys, and they will tell you straight they couldn't work with him or her or whatever. So basically, in conclusion, the whole system needs a complete restructure to get the right calibre of person to do the job properly and effectively. So otherwise nothing's going to change.
Set the refresh button too there,
absolutely.
Steve.
Absolutely.
Are you thinking of running for politics?
Well, I've been tempted a few times, but quite frankly, I couldn't work with some of the clowns that are there now. I'd only last about 5 minutes. I work for myself, so I can pick and choose who I deal with. But you know, like dealing with these people, you know, literally there are a lot of good ones, but a lot of them are not that smart. They've never been in the real world. They're trying to implement policies that aren't going to work, but they won't listen to people that are telling them otherwise. So they're just wasting everybody's time, and you know, all they're worried about is, you know, their perks. And, you know, like small business is a classic example. Here they are giving people advice on small business. 99% of them have never run a small business, so how would they know? You know, it's all preaching. So, yeah, it's a big list. But, yeah, I agree, the whole system needs to hit delete and start again and to get the right calibre of person that really are interested and genuine. Like they were 20 or 30 years ago, some of those politicians were self-made men. They weren't there for the money, they were there for the genuine reasons, but that's all changed. So that's my 20 cents worth.
I reckon that was worth more than 20 cents,
oh,
Steve.
That's just off the top, you know, but we need, no one trusts them. You know, like, the moment they open their mouth, everybody just shuts off. And even worse, the younger generation, like, I'm in my 60s and I've got young kids that are, you know, growing up, 25, 30. They're not interested because, you know, like you can imagine, what they just don't believe anything they say. So that's not a good sign.
No, not at all.
when I was 25 or 30 growing up, you know, I respected the Prime Minister and the ministers. Now they just laugh at them. So where's it all going to end? You know, it's very sad, to be quite honest with you.
Hopefully not in tears, Steve, but
it needs a change, but I just hope it's done sooner rather than later. You know, that's the issue.
Okay. Steve there in Tanimera, love your work. Why did we need a whole hour, Antinen? He's just basically summed it up in 60 seconds.
Well, he has, and he's pointed to something that I think John Anderson was pointing to as well, which is actually we need to embrace our civic responsibility. I mean, Tony Windsor, who's been quite active, I think, in the last couple of weeks in the Barnaby Joyce kind of matter, has a great quote which goes a little bit like this. You know, the world is run by those who turn up. So by not turning up, by not getting involved, by not embracing our civic responsibilities, I guess we can't complain about what we get. But, you know, there are lots of deterrents, lots of disincentives to people to be involved in such a conflictual business, I think particularly for women.
Mm, yes. And Tina, as well, Steve was going there to the idea of career politicians there, that a lot of politicians in now, well, they were either on the Labor side in unions or on the Liberal side, they were lawyers.
Or staffers.
Or staffers.
They've all been staffers. Yeah.
A lot of that. And that's actually backed up as well by former ABC bureau chief in Canberra. He was also bureau chief for The Age newspaper for many years, Russell Barton, who says there are too many professional politicians these days. They've done nothing else but develop their dark arts without any policy nous.
Mm, I think that's right. And I think that the business community is calling this out big time. The Institute of Company Directors, CEDA, the Business Council are all saying this. And this is what accounts for the short-termism, an incapacity to think longer term because of the permanent campaign and careerism. Yep, definitely.
And Antinen, if you look at the polls, we don't like Malcolm Turnbull much. We don't like Bill Shorten much either. Do you think that we're more dissatisfied with our politicians than we used to be? Do you think we expect more from them these days?
Are they
not delivering anything? Like, where's the fault?
Well, fault, see, now that is a problem. is there a fault or is it a complex range? Look, I think the first thing, Emma, is we poll much more than we used to. And is that a healthy thing? You know, probably not, particularly not for Malcolm Turnbull in the next couple of weeks. I think some colleagues of mine have written a terrific book, a two-volume book on the history of the prime ministership. And the second one has come out recently, and they've got a fantastic conclusion that I recommend to all your readers about, all your listeners about. You know, the structural factors that are making it really hard, and John Anderson pointed to some of these. But we're at a point in time where John Anderson talked about the instability at the start of Federation. We saw it again in the 60s. We saw it again, in the 20s and 30s in Australia. It's kind of like the ideas regime has run out and nothing has replaced it. So there's no compelling idea or proposition, you know, like Keynesianism to replace, you know, free markets after the Depression or whatever. So we're kind of at that point. And I think in the absence of a coherent
really
guiding philosophy.
Ideas.
Yeah. So if you think about Hawke, Keating, early Howard, the guiding idea was microeconomic reform, competition, Australia has to become competitive. What's the big idea now?
Innovation.
Well, yes, but it's not a big idea, is it?
No.
And then they retreat from it really quickly. So it's not their own lack of ideas. It's like an ideas regime. So we're sort of at the end of neoliberalism or, you know, very market-driven things, and people are pointing to questions about well-being, how am I doing as a consequence of these reforms? Nothing's really replaced it. So we project onto leaders, very leader-centred politics, has encouraged us to project onto people like Malcolm Turnbull all our hopes and aspirations. Governments have never had less control over more. So leader-centred politics, the permanent campaign, encourages us to think of them as very powerful, but they're actually really dependent on a whole lot of other people to get things done. And they won't admit that dependency because nobody wants to hear that you can't influence things. So there's a lot of structural factors going on. My colleagues have nailed it. The pivot of power. I recommend it to you.
Mm, gosh, I need to read that. Got some calls coming in now. I think you may have had just a bit of time to think about what you think on this, and now the call's coming in. So we've got Simon in Budrum. What do you think, Simon?
Oh, hi, Emma. Look, I think it all pivots around how everything's become elitist, and, you know, like the working class and the middle class used to contribute to a lot of functions in Australia, and we've just been bumped out of everything. It's just become elitist.
So you're feeling completely disregarded?
Well, I think most, I think people that are not in a position of power, which is anyone other than the elite, feel disempowered. You know, look at wages, look at, you know, the way people are being treated. It's the whole thing, you know, unionism's at an all-time low in Australia. You know, everything's become elitist. I think that's what the story is. Look what's happened in America. You know, the disparity between the haves and the have-nots is absolutely appalling, and Australia is falling in that step very much so. And it's like we're the worm in the water, and the water's gradually getting hotter and hotter and hotter. You know, people have got to realise what a dire situation we're all actually really in.
Gosh, Simon. Okay, not feeling too good there then. A worm in the hot water. Dave in Samford, what do you think has gone wrong with federal politics?
Yes, Emma, thank you very much for getting back to me again. When I was talking to you before about disability, I'm a very strong advocate for people on the disability, because I'll just tell you something, just shortly. I have actually many disabilities. I was on a pension a long time ago, about 10 years ago. I got off that, and I tried to, I tried their plan, actually, you know, trying to return people back to the workforce. And I tried.
Hey, Dave, do you know what? I reckon we're going to have a whole show looking at people with disability and what life is like. Do you mind if we call you back for that one?
Oh, yes, thank you very much.
Thank you, mate. This one today, what's gone wrong with federal politics? Ann Tiernan's here from Griffith Uni, and I just want to get a couple more callers on. So this is going to be super quick. This is David. David, where are you?
Oh, hi. I'm from Western Australia, grew up in Queensland. I'll keep this really short. What's broken with politics is very simple. Blind Freddy can see it. Number one, we've moved on. There ain't no such thing as left and right anymore. We just care about good policy. Number two, absolutely, the party system has been manipulated by the vested interest to basically make the rich get richer, which is once again blatantly obvious.
One more, David.
So, number three, and this is the scary part, 40% of jobs in Australia in the next 20 years are going to be automated out of the economy. We have an emergency. This isn't about a big idea. This is about getting a whole lot of truly representative people together and sorting this out. Otherwise, we have chaos on our doorstep.
Ooh, okay.
As that.
Gee, okay, yes. The automated jobs issue is a huge one, isn't it? One more caller, Anne in Nambour. What do you think's gone wrong?
Hi, I think we expect a bit of capability and competence from our politicians, and they disappoint us. The pink bats, Gillard's single mother thing, the NBN, the automated Centrelink, Indigenous Health, the Murray-Darling, the NDIS, and they can't do any of it right, and we're just sick of them. We want somebody competent with some good ideas for Australia that are not all about them, and to end the rhetoric and just get some good practical ideas. Thank you.
And for PM. Wow, Anne Tiernan, listening to that, there was just a list of things that have gone wrong. We don't hear very often about lots of things that are going right. Is that the media's fault?
Well, lots of things are going right every day, right? Lots of things are going right all the time. What Anne was pointing to there was things that are beyond the jurisdictional competence of the federal government a lot of the time. So, those programs for the stimulus were conceived in haste. There's a lot of, we can demonstrate the sort of centralisation and the lack of engagement of expertise around the design of programs. Much more small group decision making. In fact, there's a Joint Committee of Public Accounts inquiry in Canberra looking into some of these issues at the moment. So I think, Anne's spot on, but we do have to remember, and John Anderson encouraged us to think so, Australia is extraordinarily well governed, let's be clear, but it's like that by design, because people got involved, because people participated, because we held people to account. And I think that's the civic responsibility people are looking to
embrace.
We get
the government we deserve?
Well, we've had some governments that we deserve, and there's been some big structural changes. The question is for me, what now? What can people do? And it's not by disengaging, it's about by becoming engaged. And we've seen some of this really interestingly with young people in the US in the wake of this tragic shooting in Florida. We've seen, you know, young people's activism. So, you know, I'd like to see some more vibrancy among people and getting involved rather than, I mean, the callers have been terrific, but we can all be commentators. We need to kind of decide, you know, what responsibility we take as citizens.
Stephen Tanamera, I think that message was for you. Steve, who's been tempted to actually run in politics, and Tin, and really appreciate your thoughts on this today. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
And your thoughts and calls as well. So many that we did not get to, but stay tuned for Friday when we may come back to a few of your calls and text messages as well. The last one, I reckon, goes to Sean from Tenerife, who has said, has politics really changed? Has it? We need to remember the poison of periods such as the late Chifley rule and Menzies and his anti-communist obsessions. Perhaps now it just moves more quickly and we can see and hear everything. Maybe in such an age, Menzies might not be the hero many hold him up to be. More deep thinking to go on after this one, I think. Far out. Sean, thank you so much. I'll be back with you tomorrow from 10 till 11 with another episode of Focus. You can find this online at our website. It'll be up there in about an hour.